The back cover of Sahar Alam's debut novel, The Groom to Have Been, calls the book, quote, a love story inspired by the age of innocence. Although we encounter no exotic temptress like Countess Oleska, the social customs, institutions, and arranged marriages of these modern Indian immigrants and their families have fascinating similarities to Edith Wharton's New York society in the 1920s. Like Newland Archer, Nasser, Sahar Alam's main character, struggles between a showy social marriage and love, or perhaps a romanticized love, and maybe even romantic love. But The Groom to Have Been is inspired by, not modeled by, the age of innocence. And I find as many similarities to Jane Austen as Edith Wharton. Behind every gesture or scrap of dialogue or nuance, character action, or even a character's inaction, we encounter paragraphs of subtext and interpretation and code cracking of the social mores and complicated customs of these traditional communities, most of whom come from Lucknow, a region in India notorious for extreme politeness and ritualized indirection and verbal dithering. Right out of Mansfield Park, right? Neither Jane Austen nor Edith Wharton contend with events as specific and horrific as September 11th, however. The societies in The Groom to Have Been are far from insulated, and Nasser and his family struggle with new fears and old prejudices torn by a new world Islam and a golden age of Islam which may or may not have ever existed. Sahar Alam dramatizes these themes of love, tradition, social standing, gender politics, and religion in an increasingly global community with sharply drawn, poignant scenes at bowling alleys, nightclubs, and living rooms. My favorite being when Nasser visits a prospective bride and, over tea and snacks, must choose her correctly from three identically clad, shrewd, and bejeweled sisters. Her writing and characters are richly imagined and realistic, yet also evoking something of a fairy tale or mythic quality, which perfectly captures the new world in the aftermath of September 11th. A graduate of Princeton University, where she majored in chemical engineering, Sahar Alam studied in the creative writing program at Boston University. She was a fiction fellow at Emory University, and her stories have appeared in Best of the Fiction workshops and the journal Literary Imagination. She was born in Lucknow, India, and moved to the United States when she was 5, and now lives in St. Louis. Please welcome our very own Sahar Alam.
Thank you all so much for coming, and thank you, Richard. That was really great. And thanks to River Styx and Duffs for inviting me and hosting this event. Can you hear me? I'm going to be reading two passages from the novel, and both of them provide backstory on chapter one, which I'm skipping. In that chapter, the main character of the book, Nasser, becomes engaged to a woman named Farah, but we, like Nasser, catch only a few brief glimpses of Farah during the engagement party, and we learn that the two of them have met only twice. Also in chapter one, we briefly meet Jamila, an old childhood friend of Nasser's, whose opinions become more troublesome for him as the book progresses, and the other characters I'll be mentioning are Jamila's parents, Hamid uncle and Salat auntie. The first passage I'll read is from an excerpt from chapter 2, when Nasser first consents to an arranged marriage and the search for his bride begins. And the second involves a bit of a leap forward, about 50 pages, to chapter 6, in which Nasser meets Farah for the first time. And that chapter I'll read in its entirety. And this is really brief, but you may already know some of these terms, but they don't always look like the way they're pronounced or how I might pronounce them. So here's just a quick survey of foreign terms. Namazi refers to a person who is known for praying diligently. Rupatta is a piece of fabric worn by a woman. It's like a scarf or a shawl, and it sometimes covers her hair, but it's not a veil. It's something like this. Nasser's mother uses the phrase sidhi sadhi when talking about a prospective bride, and this loosely means plain and simple. Imam is a Muslim cleric. Appa is the term for big sister. Lucknow, as Richard said, is the city in India where Nasser's family is from, and it used to be the capital during the Mughal period. Nasser's sister Yasmin uses the term Fabio, F-O-B-I-O, which is a word that's entirely made up. It's derived from cross-pollinating fresh off the boat with the hunky Fabio of the Harlequin covers. And in chapter 6, the word Kaaba refers to the black stone building at Mecca that Muslims go to do their Hajj. And by the way, there's no need to feel bad or unfamiliar about not knowing these terms. My mother read the book last summer, and she needed translations as well, though the words she needed were prosciutto and nostalgia. In chapter 6, Nasser refers to something he calls that empty room of Jamila's, and that's a metaphoric room that'll sort of be evident when I read it. I think that's all the pre-information you need. So this is the groom to have been, chapter 2. Everybody knew that arranged marriages were for desperate people, old, maidy, overeducated, semi-Western girls who weren't pretty enough or meek enough to attract men on their own, and straight from India computer degree guys who had adolescent expectations and weren't patient enough or suave enough or were altogether forbidden by their mothers to date. Nasser wasn't desperate, and this he thought when he finally agreed to let his mother find him a bride would be his chief tactical advantage. The search for this bride began in earnest on Nasser's next trip back to Montreal. He, his mother, and his sister, younger sister Yasmin, who was essential to the process because she could communicate with their mother more efficiently, swept the local counties. They went to awkward teas hosted by nervous parents, sat in spacious, empty living rooms, as well as cramped and steamy ones, pretending that the questions being asked were merely sociable. Your family is from what region? Which region? Ah, yes, and before that they were. And how long have you been away? Every so often, Hamid uncle and his wife, Felith auntie, would come along on these visits, lending the occasion some old world formality. But even when the two of them didn't attend the meetings, they were almost always present for the lengthy discussions that followed, in which the merits of the latest prospect were debated. Sometimes these discussions spilled into the informal dinner parties Nasser's mother hosted when he was home visiting, or at the fancier functions for the Eid holidays. And they also, Nasser suspected, went on when he wasn't around. For if his mother was on the lookout, all her friends and entire network of aunties would also feel charged with the task. When he was part of the debates, Nasser found that he didn't mind having other people in the room. It allowed him to say what he couldn't say to his mother when they were alone. Too young, too religious, too dependent, too quiet, too dowdy, too brainy, too ditzy, too desi, too Pakistani, too modern, too American. To be fair, he often invited others to air their impressions. Yes, yes, to wear a skirt on such an occasion does show poor judgment, after all. This was his mother. Well, it's the quality of the family that is not what it could be. Hamid uncle. I didn't like her brother. He was a total Fabio. Yasmin. Nasser was well aware that his mother wanted a certain kind of daughter-in-law, and that, although it had taken him a while to realize it, some of her requirements actually matched what he had in mind for a wife. But since Sunni Muslim girls from good families who spoke enough Urdu to teach it to their children didn't exactly hang out in bars, he was agreeing to an arranged marriage, yes, but his consent was not without certain conditions. Marriage to him would not mean what it meant to those bozos who came from abroad expecting fresh chapatis for dinner every night and who got nervous when the conversation turned to anything other than their work, their nostalgia, or the latest episode of ER. He didn't want an unassertive woman, just the opposite, in fact. Too modern, Felith auntie said once with a raised eyebrow. I want a balanced individual, auntie, Nasser replied, trying to be diplomatic. She rolled her eyes at Nasser's mother in sympathy, these children and their wanting. But Nasser's mother waved away the sympathy, didn't need it. No, she said, you will not be believing what goes on these days, Felith, with some of these girls in this boyfriend business. No telling how many there have been in the past or even in the present. When Nasser had made this suggestion to his mother, it had been pure speculation, a convenient way to slip out of a prospect that was in danger of looking promising to everyone but him. The real problem was that he hadn't felt a spark, something that could make him forget why he was there, but that was hardly an objection he could expect his mother to understand. We think our people are so honorable, she continued, but it happens all the time. One fine day, the father finally loses patience, wraps the girl up in a rebata, and places her before unsuspecting people like us, as if she's been a namazi all her life. One has to be careful. This is why I like that girl Saman. Nice face, no fuss was, very sivhi-savi. Saman was a girl from Windsor, whom they'd all met on Nusser's previous trip. He'd had numerous objections to her as well, but his mother was apparently still not convinced that too smiley and talks too much about the joys of knitting were negatives. She's from Windsor, he said, but failed again to make his point. After a few more rounds of searching in Montreal came a couple of trips to Toronto. Soon, Nusser ruled out the girls who'd arrived from India and Pakistan too recently. The half-generation before his own, his older sister Cyrus' group, had suffered the growing pains of engagements made between first cousins, because that was the only acceptable option left, and marriages in which one or the other spouse was imported straight from India, as new to the West as an infant. We're not the same species, he told his mother, cutting off her protests. It would be like marrying someone from your generation. Once in a while, his objection of too young incited a full-blown quarrel. The prescribed difference is 6 years, his mother would say, and this girl is only 5 years younger than you. I mean emotionally, Ma, Nusser explained, then adjusted the objection to not educated enough, or not educated well enough, too young in her career, in what she wants, in how she thinks. Having spent only a few supervised moments with each girl, he couldn't be entirely sure of the accuracy of such judgments, and to her credit, his mother wasn't always fooled. What sort of virtue is age to look for in a girl, she asked helplessly, when the search reached its one-year anniversary. Do you want me to marry just anybody? Nusser countered. She didn't, of course, and her own natural prejudices often spared him from making the really crass objections. His uncles, those practiced bachelors, could and often did say, not pretty enough, or too fat already. But Nusser stuck to just not right, and let his mother mutter in agreement, yes, a big nose, or the color is not clean. It was during such exchanges that Nusser became most conscious of Jamila's presence. She happened to be there for many of these discussions, though perhaps this was because the only discussion being had these days when their families got together was about his search. And although Jamila hardly ever contributed much, and she often seemed sleepy, bored, or distracted, there were regular indications that she was listening. One time, when the rest of them were in the kitchen, arguing vigorously, and Jamila back in the den, reading, Thelathanti said, Nusser Mia is a regular... Honey, what is that girl with the three Goldilocks? Came the reply in a dry tone from the other room. In its second year, the search expanded into the States, then England, a radius so wide that it became impossible for anyone to come along with Nusser on visits, many of which he scheduled around business trips, adding a day here and there whenever he could. He told his mother where he'd be going in advance, so she could inquire about the prospects in that city. And soon he was following up on recommendations made to her by friends of friends and contacts of contacts, people who knew people who knew people who had a daughter, a sister, a niece of marriageable age in this province or that country. Yasmin began with the efficiency of the engineering major that she was, keeping a packet of his vital statistics ready for distribution, so photos were exchanged and resumes faxed before his arrival. But Nusser always returned with bad news. Too Californian. Too British. Too loud. Too shy. Can't speak Urdu. Doesn't care to learn. Not willing to live outside Sacramento, Trenton, London, Dallas. Too money-minded. Too tall. Has dirty fingernails. Her mother's too conservative. Her dad, too imami. Nusser's older sister, Syra, who lived in Texas with her husband and three children, began lightly complaining. I hope he's not expecting to meet Miss America. What is that supposed to mean? Nusser asked when Yasmin relayed the comment to him during one of their phone calls. Occasionally it would occur to him that the time and effort required for the search wasn't perhaps fair to his sisters, but he still felt he had a right to be choosy. He had, after all, worked hard to become the youngest manager his department had ever promoted, and he still had his looks. But Nesser hadn't expected the search to become a condition of his life. For almost 3 years, instead of going out with friends, he'd spend a few hours with strangers in a strange city. And even when he did go out with people he knew, he wound up trying to appreciate the evening as if it were his last. His last time drinking, his last time returning to his apartment without giving a thought to keeping anyone waiting. If they went to a bar, he would drink steadily, but not outrageously. If they were at a club, he would dance, but only until someone grew tired and suggested they sit the next one out. He was never inspired to actually enjoy himself anymore. Next week, he would think, or next month, he would meet the woman he would marry, and this life would all be over. He would drive a rental car an hour or two out of his way to her parents' home in the suburb. He would be welcomed at the door as if he were a long-lost relative instead of a stranger who'd gain entry on the good word of a distant mutual acquaintance. Her father, gray-haired and froggy-eyed, with a professional but slightly apologetic handshake, would lead him into their living room. Nesser would be served tea by her mother. He would be fed a biscuit, a stale sweet dish, or pretzels. He would accept seconds of whatever he was offered, though it would taste like nothing in his mouth. Her mother, before retreating into the kitchen, would smile at him shyly but kindly, almost as if she felt sorry for him. And an older brother, or younger if he wasn't too young, would emerge and also shake Nesser's hand and sit down to chat with him and the father. The men would discuss the clarity of the directions, the father remarking, as though he were a native, on how rapidly the city, Atlanta, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Boston, was developing. They would talk about Nesser's job in New York, his career plans, how long ago his family had come from Lucknow, the brother's nervous hopes for med school or law school, a fondly remembered trip the father had taken as a boy from his own hometown to Lucknow, the Paris of the East, he would call it, with a sigh of approval. No one would say anything that alluded to the reason Nesser was there, but he would sense that everything he said was being noted appreciatively, especially the references to his family. In fact, names and histories were sometimes so successfully recognized that it was as though Nesser had arrived with a ghostly entourage of long-dead grandfathers and great-aunts, all with enduring reputations for uncommon philanthropy, imperial piety, or simply an artful way of bringing a bite to their lips. In such a room, under all this warmth and expectation, Nesser would feel his manners expand and grow fine, his command of Urdu become crisp. He would answer the questions put to him as generously as was appropriate, with all the formal ops and jihas, and he would genuinely become what his interviewers supposed him to be, a lone but representative member of a formidable clan. No one had ever worked this hard, Nesser would think, or acquainted himself with this many people in order to meet just one. Certainly not his own father, who had been shown a pleasing photograph and told a name. At some point, the mother would reappear, probably silently in the doorway. She would be a stout, harshly aged figure in a shapeless shalwar kameez. Upon her arrival, the conversation would break. A hush would descend, after which another figure would appear. Slimmer, taller, almost always a shade fairer, she would stand beside her mother in a plain or ornate shalwar suit. She might have a rupatta draped over her head. Her hair might be black, thick, and glossy, or sleek and brown with tawny highlights. The mother might have allowed for some makeup, or she might have insisted on a strictly modest presentation. Nesser always felt that he could instantly ascertain the situation, guess, thanks to his sisters, the whole history of the preparation for this visit, the kinds of battles that had been fought, all from one look, from how she stood there, from how she came into the room, smiling, and sat down between brother and father. Sometimes people spoke for her. Sadia is getting a master's degree. Dazin is studying to be a nurse. Sabiha enjoys cooking. Mariam will be 19 in April. Sometimes she spoke for herself. Is it cold all the time in Canada? I've always wanted to see New York. How old are you? The woman you want, Jamila declared one afternoon, the female equivalent of yourself, would never let this be done to her. When it was in the middle of a speech, Jamila's voice could seem sincerely speculative, as though she'd been open to your views, and now you ought to extend the same courtesy to her as she delivered her own thoughts on the matter. But Nesser knew her well enough to recognize that this was a trap, a false reasonableness designed to disguise the fact that her mind was completely made up. That woman, she continued now, would have, like you, on your better, smarter, more self-aware days, assessed the odds and come to a very different conclusion. And what's that? Nasser asked, letting his irritation show. And this is chapter 6. The house, when Nasser found it, was tiny, a simple box of white vinyl siding with two small windows in front, one overlooking a narrow patch of yard, the other a black, shiny asphalt driveway. On both sides, it was attached to houses that looked much like it, and the sad-faced trio was embedded deep in a treeless subdivision around which Nasser had spent the better part of an hour driving, lost. On Sunday, Cornwall could be reached in 45 minutes from Montreal, but Nasser was a full 2 hours late. He was greeted at the front door by a short man in his 50s, wearing a light dress shirt untucked over blue pants. The man, who introduced himself as Parvez Ansari, had graying eyebrows, but the trim beard, no mustache, contouring his jawline was very white. He smiled briefly and stood inside the house, holding aside the screen door, but not exactly inviting Nasser in. Mr. Ansari asked how the traffic had been, and kept glancing back over his shoulder while Nasser made his apologies. Nasser couldn't tell whether the man was nervous or annoyed, and he was even more puzzled when Mr. Ansari suddenly stepped back from the door and began warmly gesturing him in. The entryway was a cramped area with linoleum flooring. A half-step turn delivered Nasser to a small carpeted living room. There, a middle-aged woman with a wide face, her hair completely covered in a white headscarf that looked as thick as a dinner napkin, stood beside a couch on which three girls were seated. Each girl had a rupatta lightly draped over her head, and they all dressed in nearly identical shalwar suits of a plain pinkish beige. Nasser saw their downcast eyes, their carefully crossed hands and scrubbed clean, colorless faces, and thought, I'm getting too old for this. He nearly announced that he had a flight to catch and couldn't actually stay. But Mrs. Ansari gestured anxious fingers toward an armchair. Come, sit here. Glancing back toward the girls, none of whom had stirred, she offered him a cup of tea. Nasser accepted and stood waiting for Mr. Ansari to sit down to seat himself in the other armchair, but the older man stayed at the far end of the room by a saloon-style set of swinging doors, as though he'd been planted there, and Mrs. Ansari now moved to join him. Nasser eventually sat in the seat opposite the three figures. The room was dim and furnished with the barest of essentials, the sofa, two armchairs, a coffee table, except for an unframed brownish-gold hologram of the Kaaba that hung over the sofa and a grocery store calendar tacked beside the saloon doors. The walls were empty. From his perch, Mr. Ansari apologized for the complicated directions so hesitantly, as if he wasn't sure if it was his place to speak, that Nasser wondered if the man's gruff manner at the front door had been accidental. He assured Mr. Ansari that the directions were absolutely right, and he made a little story up about how he'd misread his own handwriting and thus kept missing a particular turn. None of the girls said a word or even looked up. After years of meetings like this, Nasser had thought he'd perfected the art of disguising his glances at the girl he had come to investigate, and he would usually do it while explaining something about his job to the parents as though the daughter of the house were the last thing he was interested in. But with the three Ansari girls just sitting there and neither Mr. or Mrs. asking him any substantial questions, he could hardly keep himself from openly staring. Up close, the major themes of the girls' features were apparent: smooth, pale cheeks and thick, dark eyelashes. But the lineup of profiles also accentuated slight variations. One girl had solemn, delicate eyebrows. Another soft but well-shaped and vaguely smiling lips. The middle one had more difficulty keeping her eyes down than the other two. Had the three of them been sitting there like this for the past 2 hours? Mrs. Ansari asked again after tea, and Nasser again said yes. She mentioned bringing out a small snack and lingered for another moment. Then, prompted by someone, Nasser couldn't tell who, she and her husband slipped out through the swinging doors. The girl on the left, and therefore farthest from Nasser, spoke first. One of us is Farah, and the other two are her sisters, Suraya and Rafia. You should speak freely and direct all your questions to Farah as if the two of you were alone. Anything you ask about her, us, or our family will be answered truthfully to the fullest extent of our knowledge. But not necessarily by the person you ask, said the middle one, who seemed relieved at not having to look down anymore. The girl on the right then added, our parents have agreed not to disturb or eavesdrop. Mummy may come back for tea, but that will be the only interference. Nesser felt his mouth hanging open and immediately shut it. He'd been expecting something, of course, but the sudden animation was disorienting, as if statues in a museum had come to life, and for a moment it seemed as if one voice were coming from three faces, or was it three voices from one face? This way, the girl on the right continued, nobody has to feel self-conscious or in the spotlight. And we may ask you questions, said the girl on the left with the delicate eyebrows, which must be answered truthfully unless they are too personal in nature. You may at that time say that only Farah will be told the answers to that question. The right-hand girl, who was closest, said, at the end, the other two will leave the room and you can tell her the answers to those questions in private. If you choose correctly, said the middle girl. Oh, yes, the left one added. You must decide, based on our answers, which one of us is Farah. If you guess correctly, you'll be allowed to speak to her alone. If you don't, or don't want to, or say you don't know, the whole thing is over and you can be on your way. And nobody's feelings will be hurt, said the middle one, looking quite proud. Since both sides will have a choice, added the one on the right, since both sides will have a choice, the girl on the right finished explaining. Nesser could feel the heat under his arms, wetting his shirt and turning it cold. He was having trouble anticipating who would speak next and kept getting caught staring at the wrong face. You go first, said the middle one, leaning forward in her seat. First, he said, a question. Are you all, he cleared his throat again, are you all the same age? How old are you? You think we're triplets? Said the middle one, a little gleefully. She had the roundest face of the three and the roundest features. Do we look? The one on the right said, there's about a year and a half between each of us. She seemed friendly, but reserved, more inclined than the others to look down when she wasn't speaking. Nesser ventured, Farah is in grade. Farah is 23, the girl on the left said. She was not frowning exactly, but she seemed concerned somehow. Rafia is 22 and Suraya is 20. She had a slightly longer, narrower face. We are all in university. They had very dark eyes, Nesser noticed, especially for such fair skin, but he was beginning to distinguish shades now. What is Farah? He began generally, then turned directly to the one on the left, whose eyes were the biggest and lightest of the three pairs. Were they this large, serious eyes of an oldest child under an oldest child's long, serious forehead? What are you majoring in? He asked her. But the middle girl jumped in to answer. Farah is majoring in mass communications and policy. She will complete her degree next spring and hopes to ultimately get a master's in health. Public health, she added, and that was it. Nesser eliminated her as a possibility. Where did you grow up? He asked. In Cornwall? He watched the other two while the middle girl continued in her scripted tones to explain that Farah and Rafia were born in Bombay and Suraya in Dubai, where the family had lived for a year before coming to Canada. Didn't they already tell you these things? The one on the left asked, interrupting her sister. Nesser felt all three pairs of opaque eyes on him. I suppose, he replied, though he couldn't remember one word his mother had said yesterday. You might want to ask about something that only Farah can tell you, continued the serious one, the one on the left. Like what? He asked. Like what her favorite color is, said the middle one. Or something you really want to know, added the one on the right. She might have just smiled at him. His glance back at her was a fraction of a second too late. Or she might have smiled at her sister's suggestion. Or her perfect lips were always half-smiling. What's your favorite color? He asked her. Red, answered the middle girl. Then she looked at the sister to the right. There it was, Nesser thought. And then she just as hesitantly looked at the sister to the left, who said, actually, it depends. Maybe they had more tactics than he guessed, orchestrated interruptions, pre-planned vacillations. Maybe it was too easy that the responsive, clearly young one wasn't the bride and that the shy, serious one was, or that the one on the right, smiling at him, flirting with him, was the troublesome middle child. And what was his role? What was he supposed to do? Appeal to one woman or to all three? He'd never tried to charm three women at once. Depends on what? He asked belatedly. Is it finished here? Mrs. Ansari came in carrying a large serving tray. Fado, come on, Beta. The middle girl made a squeaking noise, and the other two jumped up to relieve their mother, telling her that she should have called out when tea was ready. Mrs. Ansari relinquished her platter unwillingly. Now, Nesser will be wanting to talk to everyone, she said. She seemed ready to assert herself, but then the girl on the left took command of the teapot, and the one on the right said he'll get plenty of chance for that, in her quiet but final tones. Which one of them had signaled to their mother that she should leave, Nesser again wasn't sure. But that there had been a signal was apparent, for the poor woman turned on her heel and left without another word. While the sisters busied themselves with serving the tea, the middle girl asked Nesser about his job, and if he could be anything else, what would he be? And if he could live anywhere in the world, would it still be New York? And also, when was his birthday, and what kind of music did he listen to? What was a typical day in his life like? Did he enjoy travel? Was he close to his sisters? What were his nieces' names and ages? What were his hobbies? And the last movie he'd seen? And would he say he did any sort of cooking?